Namaste and blessings. Welcome to Meditative Living. This is Swami Shivanandagiri, your host for Meditative Living. We've been away for a while, but now we're back. Sonic over in Brighton, England is running the board, pushing the buttons, making the music happen, and doing his best to make everything sound as close to professional as one can get for free, which is the Type 1 way here on Type1Radio.com. Today, we will continue. This will be episode number 13 in the Authoritative Guru Gita series. So what we're doing here is going through a book entitled The Authoritative Guru Gita of H.H. Mahamandalishwar Paramahamsa Swarupananda Vishwaguru Maharaj, who is the guru of this Swami, the one who made this Swami a Swami. And all of this was translated from the Guru Gita from Sanskrit by Acharya Padma Najendra, and translated to English. And, well, here we go. If you haven't heard episodes 1 through 12, this Swami would strongly recommend you go back to number 1 and start there, because this is very, very deep, advanced stuff. And to jump in at midstream is not going to do you much good at all. So, if you have not heard episodes 1 through 12, please go and do that and then rejoin us in future. Okay, so the Authoritative Guru Gita. Okay, the Guru Gita is a conversation between Shiva, the Mahadeva, or the God of Gods, and his wife, Parvati. Because Parvati comes along one day, and you have to understand, on the day this conversation occurred, Shiva was engaged in discourse with the Saptarishis, the seven sages, whom he was, this was his first training of humans to become fully enlightened and liberated, and to pass this along to others. Now, on this day, Parvati was already enlightened and liberated, and the way she had accomplished that was nothing like all this stuff that Shiva was teaching to the Saptarishis. And there are a lot of different reasons for that, but what Shiva did with her was gave her only the practices and the explanations that were necessary for her. She didn't need to know a bunch of theoretical things, historical, none of any of that. Just what would work for her to get her from the limited ego perspective thinking I am this body separate from all other bodies, you know, from that perspective, into the fully universal unity, the one from which all comes and to which all returns. So she begins asking him, how, what, you're telling these guys what? So Shiva goes into a conversation with her, and that conversation is the ancient text known as the Guru Gita. We begin episode 13 with verse 133. Shiva says to Parvati, one should never address the Guru in a condescending or insulting manner. Such a one is sure to be reborn as a terrible demon dwelling in a forest or an arid wasteland. The commentary. The bottom line is this. One who is bound to the perspective of the limited individual, but who refuses to acknowledge the superiority and perfection of consciousness absolute, which is the Guru Tattva and the personal Guru, relative to the individual, is in error. The one who thinks that the individual knows better than the creator of all how to break out of the limitations imposed by individuality is terribly mistaken. The person who can't accept the mechanism that God has provided in order to help individuals rediscover their own essential nature isn't going to be able to do so. Their lot is to remain bound to the erroneous notion of I as distinct from an other. And all the evil and the implicit consequences that stem from that. Taking this line of reasoning a step further, one who wrongs their guru, wrongs the envoy and grace-bestowing function of God and the embodiment of compassionate service. It's bad enough for one's well-being to just wallow in ignorance. We're all in that situation until we begin our serious inward, upward, and outward path. How much worse, then, is it to presume to talk down to or insult the very human being who would help you along that path? How can anything good come from such arrogance? How stupid does one have to be to pretend that right is wrong and wrong is right? Not only does such a person not know the truth, but they claim to know that their ignorance is the truth. Under this pretext, they appeal to the counterproductive tendencies in others who are still ignorant in some misguided effort to unite as many as possible under the banner of a sort of shared stupidity. It is an accomplishment to be this stupid. This is not something that just kind of happens without having worked at it. The fruit of some labor is a stairway to heaven. The above described work is essentially the work of digging oneself straight to hell. And why wouldn't it be? Why shouldn't it be? Has anybody who's begun the work of actively feeding, defending, and promoting their stupidity ever had a change of heart by merit of the universe unconditionally rewarding incorrect behavior? No. Sometimes a rude awakening is what it takes in order for a person to change their incorrect ways and behaviors and thoughts. The message here is that one should take heed of this warning. Certain actions just are not in a person's best interest. To be on the wrong side of the guru, who is the grace-bestowing power of God in a human body for those who would come and sit and listen and practice, that's pretty high on the list of wrong actions to take. It is in the best interests of the person who isn't engaging in such activity to continue to abstain from it. In the case of one who is engaging in this sort of behavior, one has the option of fixing it now or dealing with the consequences later. Kindly allow this, Swami, to expand on this commentary. It is entirely normal and expected for there to be misunderstandings, even anger and frustration. That's entirely normal towards the guru when they are doing their very best to break you free from that which limits you and hides your full potential. That's their job. They don't have another one. That's what they do. And it is not all love and light and lollipops and unicorns and rainbows. Not in the least bit. Now, lots and lots of books get put out with stuff like that in them that just do not even go deeply into the difficulties of this path. They want to focus on that which is blissful and will sell lots and lots of books, but is not the full truth. And it's rather an unfortunate situation, but this is why there are swamis in the world. There are gurus in the world. And please understand that not every swami is a guru. A guru makes swamis. Okay? The way you can understand this, like in this swami situation, this swami, if you were to think of this swami to be like a student teacher, you would have pretty much the right idea. This swami is trained by a sadguru, one of the very few on this planet. Of course, there are others. There always are. But this swami is not guru. And everything that this swami has come to know, or that this swami is qualified to share, as well as the energy or the shaktipat that is transmitted through this swami's body, through this swami's thoughts, and this swami's words, are all the guru's work. This swami gets to watch and observe how the work happens but is not the absolute source of the work. It happens at a level higher than this Swami currently occupies. Now, this Swami is being trained to higher levels, which we won't go deeply into, but this is how it works. If you've had any exposure to, say, martial arts practice, you would know that for beginning students, there's, you know, the white belt up through the first degree black belt. And for those who don't know anything about that particular style of martial arts, they may see a first degree black belt and take them as some sort of a master, which actually they are not. They are just a serious student. And they have earned that first degree black belt by their intense practice and their learning of all the basics, and then becoming skillful in their application and occasionally asked to teach lower ranking students. But if any of you have ever known anyone who participates in the black belt classes, now that's where things get tough and things get enormously difficult. And it's a whole nother world. It really is. So please know that just because someone has a title does not put them on the highest shelf. It just means they're a serious student. Now, that very same title that one gets as a serious student can also be the one they're wearing if and when they get to that highest shelf. It just depends. And every lineage and every system will do things somewhat differently, but the end result, the goal, is the same: to assist individuated units of consciousness to not only theoretically and through mental thought processes think themselves to be more than that. No. To actually, deeply, directly experience that within themselves. It's not about intellect. Intellect gets in the way of this kind of knowledge. And it can actually be a problem to be too much of a bookworm. It can take those types longer to make it because they spend far too much time engaged in their thought processes. Well, now, for them, of course, it's appropriate, because that's how they are, and that's fine. But those types will generally take considerably longer to get all the way to the end because they will have so much confusion and doubt because they think they know all these other things that are competing or in conflict with the directions or with the right understanding. Back to the text, verse 134. Shiva said to Parvati, "One should meditate upon non-duality at all times and in all situations. However, one should not meditate upon non-duality in the presence of one's guru." The commentary: ultimately, everything resolves into the unity. which simultaneously pervades and transcends everything that can conceivably be encountered in the world of diverse phenomena. The living guru is the force that catalyzes the remembrance of this radically indivisible reality. Yet, the burden of self-effort rests upon the seeker themselves. Nobody else can take up this yoke for you. It just doesn't work that way. The essence of this self-effort is meditation upon non-duality. Here, we can use the word meditate in all of its various connotations. Now, I tell you what, Sonic, let's go ahead and run the bottom of the hour break song. When we come back, we will discuss the various connotations that all can fit into the understanding of the term meditate. We'll be back in a bit on Meditative Living. Namaste and blessings. The Swami welcomes you with great love and great respect from the heart of all. Welcome back to Meditative Living. This is episode number 13 in the Authoritative Guru Gita series. We now continue with the commentary on verse 134. Now here we're going to go deep into the explanations of the varying connotations of meditate. First, contemplation. One should meditate on non-duality by contemplating it. When thoughts that presume duality arise, the mind should be used to reaffirm non-duality. For example, if one is depressed, one should inquire into the nature of that feeling. The Spandakarika, literally the stanzas on vibration, say, just as a plunderer carries away the valuables of the house, even so depression saps away the vitality of the body. This depression proceeds from ignorance. If that ignorance disappears by unmesa, how can that depression last in the absence of its cause? Not saying that repeating these or any similar words will magically cure depression. However, it does put the matter into its proper perspective. Depression is a symptom of the deluded notion of I as distinct from an other, and the resulting attachment to me and mine. In the absence of ignorance, there is no depression. If noteworthy depression is something you are dealing with, by all means, don't let what I'm saying stop you from soliciting the appropriate help from qualified professionals. Having said that, this self-inquiry does help to weaken the erroneous assumptions that cause such distress. Stepping away from the text for a moment. This is an area that this Swami can discuss with full experience. It is not the least bit unusual for those of us who become serious, hardcore students and disciples to have dealt with or be dealing with varying levels of depression. This is not unusual. Do not think yourself weak or a failure or any of that, which is part of the depressed thought stream. That is not the case. It is a very limited situation, and it does have a conclusion. That is your full awakening. Partial awakening will not do it. Partial awakening will relieve it part of the time. You see, the great bliss that is spoken of is enjoyed sporadically through the time one spends in sadhana, in their direct practice. and their experience of life as an individuated, limited unit of consciousness. And this is very persistent. It is not a simple thing to step beyond. So, to become one of these, oh, there's nothing but love and light types is absolutely foolish. Because you must come to know directly and consciously the full spectrum of what is possible. Not theoretically. You must know it directly. This then means there will be situations which are not the least bit pleasant. There will be times, regardless whether you're at the level, any level, there is very likely to be times when things just are not fun. It is not all love and light. There is an entire spectrum, and you have to grow beyond the whole spectrum and perceive it for what it is. From the brightest, most blissful, to the darkest, most depressed, dangerous, all of it, you must come to know it in whatever way it comes to you. And there's a great deal of this stuff that's just not fun. Thankfully, when one has an actual Sadhguru, we get the support we need to get through these periods. Inwardly and outwardly. And again, please, please know, this is nothing like the new agey knuckleheads who effectively disable themselves from being able to psychologically deal with life as it is. Okay. The next connotation of the term meditate: approximation. Another way to meditate upon non-duality is to approximate it. In the midst of any situation that naturally elicits higher levels of focus and attention, that attention should be mindfully cultivated even further with the understanding, quote, the senses, their objects, and the experiences thereof, all are only the self. That's the big S, self. The one. The knower, what is known, and the knowing thereof are, in reality, one seamless existence, consciousness, bliss. End quote. Another term for this existence, consciousness, bliss is Satchidananda. There are various means of accomplishing this. Love and joy are good options, in my opinion, since people naturally gravitate towards these pleasurable feelings. When great joy is attained through any event, such as meeting with relatives, one should meditate on that with one pointedness until the mind becomes absorbed and the bliss ever arises. If one concentrates on the joy of eating and drinking. And that happiness obtained by that joy of taste from such contemplation of enjoyment arises the state of fullness, which then becomes supreme joy or bliss. As a result of concentration on the pleasures of the senses, such as music or song, the yogi experiences equal happiness or pleasure within. By being thus absorbed, the yogi ascends beyond the mind and becomes one with that, with a capital T, the supreme. Whenever there is satisfaction of mind and the mind is held there alone, the nature of supreme bliss manifests. In short, any joyful experience is an approximation of non-duality. If this joy can be attended to fully with the entirety of one's attention, the knower and what is known merge into one. Subject and object are resolved into non-duality only. But everything being Shiva, this premise need not be limited to pleasant stimuli. Whether we like it or not, pain very naturally grabs our attention also. Thus, the Vijnana Bhairava says, one should pierce any limb of the body, just a little bit, with a sharp pointed needle or any other instrument. Then, projecting the consciousness there, verily, there is a movement toward the pure nature of Bhairava, or Shiva. Now here, we encounter some examples of a particular state of ordinary consciousness that is flagged as being useful in multiple Shiva scriptures. It is said, Spanda is stable in the state one enters when extremely angry, intensely excited, running, or wondering what to do. Spanda is the pulsing vibration of consciousness that encompasses the whole of reality, originating in the subtlest of the subtle, up to and including the grossest, most concretely differentiated of forms. The text called Vijnana Bhairava makes the exact same point, giving some additional examples, such as this one. At the beginning and end of sneezing, in terror, sorrow, or confusion, when fleeing from a battlefield, during keen curiosity, or at the onset or appeasement of hunger, that state is the external existence of Brahman. Now, what is being said here might initially seem counterintuitive. After all, these are all states that are distinctly marked by agitation of some sort or another. Before commenting on this matter, let us take note of what the author of the Spandakarika has already stated. When there is no mental agitation, then occurs the highest state. The Vijnana Bhairava gives a clue in stating that these incidences are examples of, quote, that, with a capital T, that state, which is the external existence of Brahman. End quote. Thus, it is acknowledged that these remain outer manifestations, highly differentiated aspects of Spanda, characterized by agitation. What makes this state worthy of the yogi's attention is the fact that it already is inherently accompanied by a high degree of attention. When a person is gripped by hunger, that gets their attention. When that hunger is satisfied, the resulting satisfaction gets budgeted a large amount of attention also. When a man who cannot afford to feed his family unexpectedly comes into a large amount of money, his excitement cannot be ignored. When somebody is running for their life, it is pretty safe to bet that the degree of attention they are putting into the effort is about as high as it's ever been. In all of these circumstances, the individual, again, is presented with an ideal opportunity to, quote, deposit all in one place, and so be untroubled by any alien reality. In lieu of the full realization of this ideal, simply understanding the concepts that have been enumerated here, making a conscious effort to give that much more attention when these situations are encountered, one can at least approximate the experience of non-duality. Kindly allow this, Swami, to expound a little bit here. The Vijnana Bhairava is a text, again given by Shiva, that is all about centering techniques. Now, these specific techniques are things that happen in the action of living. In these ways, Shiva is pointing to specific things that will take place in your experience as an individuated unit of consciousness operating through a physical form, and what your senses will encounter in life, and pointing at those things which, because of their intensity and the natural pull of your attention in their direction, are qualified to assist you to 100% focus and become non-dual for a short period of time. To have no other thought, to have nothing else crossing the mind, to become focused, to become one-pointed, okay? Sadly, most people who consider the path of meditation and sadhana just want to focus on the good stuff. Well, that's not how it works. You have to be able to focus on the intense stuff. And it can be intensely good, or it can also be intensely not good. But it is intense. So use that intensity to your benefit. Continuing with another connotation of the term meditate. Here we will discuss seated meditation or dhyana. There are two technical terms that need to be understood regarding seated meditation, dharana and dhyana. A dharana is one of any of what are known as centering techniques. Dhyana is simply the act of sustaining attention upon the relevant centering technique. Back to the matter of the centering technique. This is an attempt at bringing one's attention to one-pointedness, which, when accomplished, somehow confers enlightenment. In the case of most people, an approximation is going to have to suffice for a good long time. But practice makes perfect. If this talk of approximation reminds you of the previous section, that is because I'm essentially describing the same thing. All of the various stimuli and circumstances enumerated in discussing phenomena that have some intrinsic attention-grabbing capacity technically are dharanas, or centering techniques. The only real distinction between what I described under the approximation heading and what I am terming seated meditation is that the former centering techniques all make use of external phenomena. In seated meditation, attention is directed inward. In this instance, the method implemented by the individual in their attempt at meditation takes the form of sitting, preferably in a clean and quiet place, with their eyes closed for a predetermined amount of time. In the tradition to which we belong, the centering technique that is utilized in seated meditation is the Guru Mantra. Now, we will get through the last bit of explanation of this verse. Not in the presence of one's guru. In review, the previous points are intended to describe how one can meditate upon non-duality at all times and in all circumstances. Yet, verse 134 further admonishes the disciple to abstain from meditating upon non-duality in the presence of their guru. In the presence of one's guru, service should be rendered to him or her. For one who is not yet completely established in non-duality, service rendered unto and love of the guru will propel the individual in that direction without any additional effort. It is better to put all of one's being into these than it is to have other things vying for their attention. One should endeavor to be a blank canvas upon which the guru can paint whatever they like. One should empty oneself as completely as possible, so they may become a fit instrument of God's will. Krishna's favorite possession was his flute. When asked why this was the case, his response was that it is only once the piece of bamboo is hollowed out that his breath can fill it, thus creating sublime melodies. This should be one's focus when in the presence of their guru. Taking in everything they have to offer with as little interference as possible. The initiate whose practice has come to its inevitable conclusion, who is permanently absorbed in non-duality, is also enjoined by various scriptures to sustain the attitude of the humble disciple to the guru. One reason for this, if we are to believe the Guru Gita, is that abandoning the guru, even in one's dying breath, can result in a fall from enlightenment. Another noteworthy reason is that consciousness seems to have some innate drive to experience itself, to divide itself up for the sake of experiencing the dynamic of lover and beloved. While the jnani, or the knower, has the ability to remain absorbed in non-differentiated modes of consciousness, so long as the condition of embodiment persists, there is also the potential to experience the world of manifestation from a unique perspective, from which one is simultaneously aware of unity and diversity. Thus, without meditating upon duality, non-duality, the fully awake disciple effortlessly partakes of the guru perspective. While they technically could completely withdraw awareness from the external world, one also has the option of participating in the dynamic of guru and disciple. While fully aware of these distinctions, we are able to perform our role in this play without ever relinquishing the bliss of the awareness of the more fundamental identity that both the guru and disciple share. That brings us to the end of episode 13. We will move on to verse 135 next week here on Meditative Living. Namaste and blessings.